Alaskans know how delicious wild-caught fish are, and the health benefits of omega-rich proteins are well documented. But how sustainable are traditional fisheries as the growth in human global population increases demand? The oceans are stressed by pollution, rising acidity, and temperature changes, making the case for fish farming to feed the masses. There have been past missteps in aquaculture. Is it getting better? Our guest went on a year-long quest to find out and joins us today to discuss his frontline special, The Fish on My Plate. All right. This is Talk of Alaska. We're having a little bit of technical difficulty this morning, but it's only with the music, so that's okay. At least our guest is on, and we'll get to that in a moment. Are you a fish snob? If you don't catch your own, do you only buy wild-caught? Some family budgets don't allow the extra expense of wild-harvested fish, so they must buy tilapia or farmed salmon, shrimp, mussels. So is that okay, health-wise? A new Frontline special that airs on PBS this evening, The Fish on My Plate, examines wild and farmed fishing practices. Paul Greenberg researched and wrote the Frontline special. Part of his research was spending a full year eating only from the sea. Fish and shellfish. Mr. Greenberg is the New York Times best-selling author of Four Fish and the book American Catch. He joins us from Argot Studios in New York. Hello.
Hey, Laurie, how are you?
I am well. Too bad we didn't have some music at the beginning, but oh well, that's okay. You're here, and that's
important. I can carry a tune if need be. You know?
We might need to tap that in a little bit. We'll see.
Okay. I'll do the outro music.
Okay, that sounds great. All right, and Alaskans, you can join our conversations too. Alaskans love to talk about fisheries. Do you think our oceans can meet world demand in the future? Are you a fisherman who has observed big changes in your career? What do you think it means for the next generation of fishermen? Do you think aquaculture has a viable place in tandem with wild fisheries? Give us a call, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. If you're calling in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So once again, we're talking about fisheries, both wild and farmed. Paul Greenberg is our guest. Paul, your special on Frontline airs this evening. So tell us what sparked this effort. Why did you decide to dedicate a year of your life to investigating and eating wild and farmed seafood?
Well, this is my third fish book that I've been working on, or I should say, I started in on, before I even did the Frontline special that's on tonight, I was in the middle of my third fish book. I called it the third in my marine trilogy. And the previous books had been, as you said, Four Fish and American Catch. And, you know, Four Fish looked at the conflict between farmed and wild. American Catch looked at the conflict between foreign and domestic fish. And this third book is called The Omega Principle. And it's really about the omega-3 fatty acid. And it's really about should we, you know, what is it about omega-3s that make seafood healthy and make us want to have it? So what happened was I was in the middle of this experiment where I decided to stop eating land food meat for a year. And so every time I would have reached for a piece of beef or lamb or whatever, I reached for a piece of fish. And I had all of my sort of biometrics done at the beginning of the year, my blood pressure, my cholesterol, triglycerides, etc. And then I just ate fish. And so I wanted to see, A, if that would affect my health, but B, when Frontline got involved, you know, they sort of wanted to go on the journey as well. And then they realized that if they were going to go on this journey, that a lot of the sort of viewing public outside Alaska doesn't really understand that there are these huge tectonic shifts going on in seafood right now. I mean, 50 years ago, everything we ate from the sea was wild. Now we're just crossing the threshold where more than 50% is going to come to us from farms. So they decided, let's make that a major aspect of the investigation. Let's make the fish eating a part of the investigation. And it all sort of came together. And I think what's a, you know, a pretty watchable piece of television.
Absolutely. You traveled all over. You started in Peru, where the anchovy fishery, is it anchovita? Is that what it's,
well,
the fish is called?
It's called the Peruvian anchoveta. It's
anchoveta,
actually it's actually the biggest fishery in the world. And I would bet even Alaskans weren't aware of that. Anchoveta, sometimes the catch of anchoveta has been as large as 15 million metric tons, which, you know, to put that in perspective, we only catch a total of 80 or 90 million metric tons from the entire ocean. So it's a huge, huge fishery. But actually, 99% of that fishery in Peru goes gets ground up into meal, boiled down into oil, and fed to farmed fish, mostly to farmed salmon. So that was that made sense to look at this fishery, which is a really transitional fishery, because on the one hand, it's got all this delicious anchovies that we could all be eating. On the other hand, 99% of it is being ground up and used for aquaculture.
You know, I was struck by just exactly what you said, that it's the largest fishery in the world. When I read that in the transcript of tonight's program, I thought, wow, I bet a lot of people don't realize that. And also the fact that it's called a reduction fishery, a point that you just addressed about how it's used. So what does that mean for this fishery?
Well, it's kind of, what does it mean for the fishery and what does it mean for fisheries in general? It turns out that 20 to 25% of all fish caught are part of what are called reduction fisheries, fisheries that are sole purpose is to be reduced down to pellets and fed either to salmon or to chickens or to pigs. What it means as a fishery is that you're ending up with a product that really doesn't sell for a lot for the average fisherman. Even though the price of aqua feed actually has gone through the roof in the last few years, on the receiving end, you know, the dockside price that fishermen are getting is really pennies on the pound. And I guess one of the thoughts that came out of that whole Peru section is, what if you could get more people to eat those anchovies? What if you, you know, had the catch but doubled the price? Wouldn't that sort of be a win-win situation for both the environment and the fishermen? Of course, you know, any fisherman out there who's listening knows that the global marketplace for fish is so weird and so unpredictable that, you know, some guy sitting in New York setting prices for anchoveta is probably not going to work. But still, you know, my goal and my role in all of this a lot of times is to point out these weird little glitches and hopefully get other people thinking about how they might get fixed.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are discussing a Frontline special that will air this evening. It's called The Fish on My Plate. And author Paul Greenberg researched and wrote this special for PBS, for Frontline. He spent a year traveling around the world looking at wild and farmed operations when it comes to aquaculture, fish, and seafood. And he's here to talk to us about this today. If you have questions, give us a call statewide, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Paul, is the anchovy fishery properly managed? There is an interesting link to Cannery Row in California's Monterey. Tell us about
that. Well, that's the million fish question. These kinds of little fish, like anchovies and sardines and herring, they have very fluid population dynamics. They go up and down depending on climatic conditions. And particularly when I went to Peru, it was an El Nino year. When an El Nino hits, the productivity of the ocean goes way down, and you really have to rethink how many fish you can catch. Now, the connection to Cannery Row and that sort of famous overfishing moment was that during the 1940s, there was a wobble in what's called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, which, again, fishermen listening will know what I'm talking about. But it just basically means the temperature and nutrient regime of the ocean changes, and the productivity goes down. And so in Cannery Row, because we didn't really have the modern metrics of good fisheries management to work with, they just kept fishing, and the fishery totally crashed. And interestingly, what we found is when we went to Peru is that a lot of the gear, the factories, the boats, it all got moved to Peru. And so it's this kind of traveling, you know, mass of fishing effort that moves where there is a fishery. Now in Cannery Row, we've got the Monterey Aquarium, but we don't have a lot of sardines being caught there anymore. So it makes you scratch your head and makes you wonder, you know, is this a viable thing to do into the future? I do believe that the Peruvian fishery is way better managed than the Monterey fishery was managed back in the 40s and 50s. But going forward, I think, especially as we enter a more crowded world, we have to ask this question, is this whole concept of reducing fisheries to make aqua feed, is that a viable solution for a planet that's going to have 9 billion people who all are going to have their protein needs and might prefer or choose to eat anchovy directly rather than have it transformed into salmon meat in a fairly wasteful process.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk more about aquaculture in a bit. But you, in this Frontline special, you visit a Boston seafood show citing incredible numbers, millions of metric tons of seafood caught each year, most from foreign fisheries, traveling thousands of miles to get to our plates. Talk about what your findings were there and what you think it kind of means for the future.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, scale. I mean, 80 to 90 million metric tons is taken out of the ocean globally every year, which is the equivalent of the human weight of China removed from the ocean every year. So, you know, on the one hand, that's a lot. It's a lot. And on the one hand, you know, you could say, gosh, what a horrible, you know, total raping of the ocean that's going on year after year, all of this metric tons being taken out. On the other hand, you could say, whoa, the ocean. We take 80, 90 million metric tons out of the ocean every year, and it still keeps producing. So I think both have things to be said that are true about the, you know, both positions. But the other thing, I think more to your point, is that seafood really travels a long way to get to your plate. The average piece of seafood in an American restaurant has traveled 5,000 miles before it hits your plate. And, you know, that's less true in Alaska because you have wonderful, you know, very productive, well-managed fisheries. On the other hand, I certainly have been in places in Alaska that couldn't get their hands on fresh fish and couldn't get their hands on local fish because of this strange, you know, globalized industry where oftentimes it's much more valuable to Alaskans to send their seafood abroad than to keep it at home.
Mm-hmm. Which nations eat the most seafood?
Well, China is certainly up there. Japan is certainly up there. If you were looking for sort of like maximal, you know, seafood intake, you'd look at some of those Pacific Island nations out there that really, you know, where that is the protein, that is what you have. And in effect, you know, that's sort of what I did to myself when I went on my all-fish diet for the last year for this Frontline documentary. When I had my blood tested, I don't want to give any spoilers away, but, you know, we do reveal the results in my blood and in my physical condition of what a year of eating seafood is like. But I will say that my blood, by the end of the year, resembled that of a Pacific Islander in terms of its omega-3 fatty acid ratio in my blood.
Oh, how interesting. I wondered if you would reveal that or not, or if you didn't want to steal the thunder for the
special. I don't want to go I won't go into whether it actually had an effect, but I, you know, it's undoubtable that my omega-3 levels went up. What was curious when I first started this project and I decided to, you know, it's very easy. I'm just going to start eating seafood. But I didn't realize all the metrics that were available to me. And it turns out there actually is a company in South Dakota called Omega Quant, which will send you a little kit and you prick your finger and you get a little blob of blood and send it in and will tell you, you know, what is the percentage of omega-3s in your blood? What is the percentage of omega-6s? Which, again, prior to the research on this book and in this film, I didn't know there was such a thing as an omega-6 or that it, you know, played a kind of contrary role to the omega-3 in the human body. We don't go into that too much in the film, but it's sort of the spine of this omega-3 book that I'll be publishing next year. So it was, you know, it was a deep dive not only into seafood, but also into blood and to the things that cause cardiovascular disease and dementia and all those kinds of things.
Well, I don't want to go too far down that road, but I just wanted to ask, based on what you just were saying about you can send in your blood and get this test.
Yeah.
Okay, so what? So you have omega-3s in your blood. What does that mean?
Well, that's the $3 billion question, right? I mean, you know, the omega-3 supplement industry is worth about $3 billion right now, $3 billion. And it's, you know, it's by far the most taken supplement of any dietary supplement in the United States. Also, omega-3s are the most, one of the most studied compounds out there. Probably second only to aspirin. There have been around 30,000 studies, anything ranging from just plain old observational studies to randomized clinical, randomized control trials. So, you know, I've been saying, you know, as I've been, you know, I've been working on this film, but I've also been working on this book, and I've been trying to kind of come up with a metaphor for the omega-3 that most people would understand, and I think I've got it. You ready for it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the omega-3
drum roll.
The omega-3 is the Forrest Gump molecule. And
Wow.
And by this I mean I assume as an educated person you've seen Forrest Gump, right?
Absolutely.
So you know how Forrest Gump, he just shows up at these extremely important times in history, and he shows up and he says something and you're not sure if it's wise or if it's illogical or stupid, and then something happens and then you move on to the next scene and you're like, I think something important happened, but I'm not sure what. So to me, this was the best way to explain the omega-3. I mean, if you look at it, the very first omega-3 studies that got people excited were in the 70s when two doctors, Dr. Bang and Dr. Dyerberg, and I should note that in the Frontline film, we actually do go to Copenhagen and find dear old Dr. Dyerberg still doing his omega-3 stuff. But anyway, Bang and Dyerberg went to Greenland, and population not unlike probably some of the villages that you have out in Alaska, where Inuit populations are eating mostly seals, seafood of various kinds. So they looked at the health records, and they found very low levels of cardiovascular disease among Inuit populations living in Greenland. And then, interestingly, they looked at Inuit populations who had emigrated, because remember, Greenland is part of Denmark, or was part of Denmark. They looked at Inuit populations in Denmark and found pretty high levels of cardiovascular population. Then they did blood lipid analyses. And they found that the Inuits in Greenland had very high levels of EPA and DHA. Those are two omega-3 fatty acids. Whereas the population living in Denmark, eating a typical Western diet, had basically very low levels of omega-3s and omega-6s and seemed to have much higher levels of cardiovascular disease. So from that comparative thing—
a more urbanized diet.
A Western diet that, that relied on, you know, grain-fed beef, a lot of dairy, basically, as I've saying in my book, an omega-6 diet, a diet of things that really comes from land food. So that set up this paradigm that got people very excited about omega-3s. But as I sort of thought through this, though, you have to be careful with what's called an observational study because it can lead you down a road that, you know, causation and evidence are not necessarily the same thing. It seems like it's heading to a certain direction, but it's not necessarily provable. And, you know, the syllogism I use to kind of demonstrate that is sometimes to test for schizophrenia, this kind of this paradigm is set up. It's like, I live in a White House, the president lives in the White House, therefore I am the president. See what I'm saying? So, like, I'm taking omega-3s or I'm eating a diet of omega-3s. I have very low heart disease in the population. Therefore, omega-3s are causing—
That must be why.
Yeah. So, but meanwhile, there are so many other confounding things. And that's the history of the last 20 or 30 years has been trying to figure out, is it the omega-3 that's causing this low level of cardiovascular disease? Or is it a lifestyle thing? Is it, you know, combination of factors? So that's where I'm sort of waiting around right now on my book. Some of that is in the film, but more of it will be in the book.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. We are talking with Paul Greenberg from— he's at a studio in New York talking to us about the Frontline special that will air this evening on PBS stations, The Fish on My Plate. It's all about his quest to find out, learn more about the world's wild and farmed fish and seafood operations. He ate fish and seafood for exclusively for a year. He joins us today to talk about this special that will be airing this evening. Paul, before we discuss aquaculture and fish farming, what did your research reveal about how wild fisheries have changed over the past century? Salmon, for instance, once had a much broader distribution in the oceans than it does now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's always a sad component when you talk about fisheries. Not so sad necessarily in Alaska, although I always think of Alaska as this kind of like wise old man that watched all the destruction to the south and kind of thought, maybe we should do things differently. But certainly we've seen in the last 60 years a quadrupling of the world catch, you know, from around 20 million metric tons around World War II, just before World War II, to 80, 90 million metric tons now. So that alone tells a very, you know, big story about the industrialization of the ocean, you know, a huge part of the buildup of fishing effort around the world was World War II, because World War II brought all of these innovations to navigation, sonar, which allows you to find fish underwater, various forms of plastics, which came out of the war, which allowed you to spin long lines miles long and nets also miles long. And so all these new technologies that came out of the war were then repurposed for fishing because, you know, you don't want to just throw away these new technologies. Let's try and use them for the greater good of humanity. I think now we're finding ourselves in a kind of ecological catch-up where now there are places like Alaska which have, I think, figured out management regimes that make sense and keep fish in the water and sustainable and plentiful. But then there's other places where the rule of law just doesn't exist and where you have this tremendous technical power to catch fish but not a lot of constitutional power to regulate the catch. Mm. And therein lies, I think, the rub for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, 550-8422. 550-8422. You can email us talk@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about aquaculture. Fish and seafood farming has been around for quite a long time, decades. You visited Norway's salmon farming operations. What did you find there?
Well, first of all, aquaculture has actually been with us for 2,000 years, 3,000 years,
ooh,
but it's only
much
really,
longer than
you know,
decades.
Yeah, well, but I mean, you're right in a sense because it began in China. It was actually one of the first applications of aquaculture. It was sort of stumbled upon where people who were growing silkworms found that the casings from the silkworms fell into the ponds. Carp ate them, and then the carp in turn fertilized the ponds that allowed rice to grow. And so it was this kind of natural polyculture. So that was the first aquaculture, and that was the way most of the world practiced aquaculture until the 1960s or so. But it was really in the 60s and the 70s when a couple of brothers in a fjord town called Hitra started growing salmon in net pens in Norway. And ever since, it has just taken off. And I mean, the thing that was most striking about being in Norway when I was there last year was just how much money people were making off of farm salmon. I mean, just a lot of money. A lot of people driving around in Teslas, and the prices just keep going up and up. And, you know, it's striking to some degree because I know that in Alaska, prices often are very low ex vessel, you know, 80 cents a pound, mm-hmm. you know, 70, 60 cents a pound. And you don't necessarily, I think because the supply chain is pretty long between the fishermen in Alaska and the end consumer, a lot of value is never realized by the fishermen. And so they really do kind of get a raw deal. At the end of the day, though, oddly enough, wild salmon is often hitting the market at a higher price point than farm salmon. So it's certainly confusing. The other interesting thing that I learned in the course of not just being in Norway, but talking to people around the fishing industry, is that I'd always seen farmed salmon as the sort of enemy of wild salmon. But in talking to an academic who had looked at the economics of it from both the farmed and wild side, what she found was that in the end, farmed salmon probably ended up increasing the consumption of Alaska wild salmon because it kind of forced the Alaskan salmon industry to stop just shoving everything into a can and start doing portions that people could cook up in their kitchen and so forth. And so while, you know, fishermen will curse farmed salmon till the sun goes down and the next day too, but in the end, at least if you believe the economists, farmed salmon seems maybe to have helped the wild salmon market in Alaska.
All right, well,
and if that doesn't get anyone calling, yeah, I don't know what will.
Yeah, that's quite the statement to put out there. We are going to go to the phones for a moment. Greg is in Eagle. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What, did you have a question?
Yes, I'm curious. I can't hardly eat a can of albacore tuna without having some type of a mercury reaction, and I was wondering how your guy there wants to know, you know, how much mercury is in the, you know, the common fish, the wild caught fish, and you know, if he had any effect, you know, from the mercury in the fish.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Greg.
Excellent question. I did track my mercury through the through the year. I'm curious to, if Greg's still there, did you have your blood checked or did you have your hair checked or was this just a physical symptom that you had?
No, it just my eyes dilated. I couldn't sleep. I felt very irritable. You know, it's happened more than once, and it's just a reaction I seem to have.
Maybe an allergy.
Could be. I mean, mercury, the symptoms that often come with mercury poisoning are loss of memory, can have a cardiac effect. And I did have – so important thing for your listeners is that if you're concerned about your mercury, just a simple blood test won't do it. What you need to do is have your hair tested. I believe the state of Alaska does do that with a lot of Inuit communities. I had my hair tested, and I did, in fact, have elevated mercury. It went from previous I had, you know, since I'm an angler and I did eat fish, I had mercury that was it wasn't ever flagged, but it was around 2 parts per million. By the end of my experiment, it went up to about 5 or 6 parts per million, depending on which sample I was looking at. I am neither a child nor a woman of childbearing age, so I didn't give it too much thought, although, you know, it has been linked to Alzheimer's. It's been linked to all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. What I was struck by is, you know, you're right to put your finger on tuna. Tuna, according to Consumer Reports, is the largest source of mercury in the American diet. And actually, I often steer people away from canned tuna towards canned salmon. I don't know how you guys feel about canned salmon, but I think it's a perfectly fine substitute for canned tuna. To me, it's much more traceable. Ultimately, I think it's more sustainable in the present market. Mercury, much, much lower. So that's what I would suggest, is that if you're worried about the mercury, I would steer towards canned salmon. That said, you know, I did stay away from mercury. I did try to stay away from some of the larger, longer-lived fish, like tilefish and so forth, that have high mercury readings. But even though I did that, because I was eating so much fish, as one of the biologists in the film says, it was death by a thousand cuts. And so there's always a little mercury in some fish. So I'd say if you stick to a couple of portions a week, sticking to wild salmon, maybe things like anchovies and so forth, probably will be okay. But tuna is definitely a red flag.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Greg. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk some more with our guest, Paul Greenberg, who is the researcher and author of a couple of books on fisheries and also tonight's Frontline special, The Fish on My Plate, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and our guest today is Paul Greenberg, who is the author of a Frontline special airing tonight called The Fish on My Plate. Paul ate only farmed and fresh wild seafood and fish for a year in his quest to learn more about the fisheries. I wanted to ask Paul about, before we go back to the phones, we've got some calls now, which is great. How are farmed fish impacting wild stocks? What you talked a little about this earlier, but what should we know about that?
Well, in Norway, where they have a great deal of farmed salmon going on, I think there's well over 1,000 farm sites in Norway. There appears to be an impact on wild salmon populations. It's hard to say how much is happening, but there is a real presence of what are called sea lice. These are parasites that cling to the outside of fish, suck their blood, their tissues, and they can jump from the farm to the wild. The people on the conservation side argue that this is negatively impacting wild salmon. And, you know, already you had serious declines in wild salmon in the Atlantic in general. And for people who follow that, they believe that this is just sort of the last blow on a fishery that has really suffered over many, many years of abuse and neglect. The other issue that comes up quite a bit is all that sort of refuse that comes out of a salmon farm, not refuse, but really just poop, to use a direct word. And because the salmon can be fed all kinds of things, you know, that stuff coming out from the salmon can have a negative effect, especially if there's a lot of nitrate wastes that can cause an algal bloom, which in turn can cause a dead zone if enough of it accumulates. The other thing that's coming up, one common way that the salmon farming industry treats farmed salmon from sea lice is to use a chemical called SLICE. And what SLICE does, it's a shell inhibitor. So it stops lice from growing a shell. But guess what else grows a shell? Well, shrimp. And throughout the fjords of Norway, I never knew this, but there was wild shrimp fisheries up and down the Norwegian coast. And the SLICE used to combat sea lice seems to be negatively impacting wild shrimp fisheries. To me, that's, you know, that's plausible. I'm, you know, I'm not a marine biologist, but certainly there was a lot of hand-wringing going on around sea lice in general.
Well, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Paul, another Paul, is in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. Hi, Paul.
Hi. You were speaking earlier about how there's 80 million metric tons of fish being taken from the ocean every year, and that perhaps you could look at that with a positive light and say, well, the oceans are sustaining this big harvest. But is it true or is it not true that the species that we're taking is kind of changing as we're searching for our fish fillets and our fish sticks, that as we're depleting one species and then moving on to another, so that while we're maintaining a harvest of 80 million metric tons, that isn't like the same species year after year after year. Do you have any info about that?
Well, you very smartly put your finger right onto a central debate going on within fishery science right now. There are those that camp is sort of being led by a marine biologist named, or a fishery scientist named Daniel Pauly, who actually appears in the Frontline documentary. We have a roundtable discussion around my dinner table in New York. And he has argued that we're doing precisely that. We're what's called fishing down the marine food webs, and that we're eating lower and lower trophic levels of fish, and we're going to end up eventually with like jellyfish and seaweed. That's the sort of nightmare scenario. The sort of opposition to the Daniel Pauly camp is a scientist in Seattle named Ray Hilborn, and he often argues that no, if you look at the data, if you look at the catch data, overall we don't see a trophic reduction in what we're catching. I don't know. You know, I have a hard time vetting that kind of science because these are big, big studies looking over huge amounts of fisheries. What I will tell you, and this is something that also comes out of Dr. Pauly's work, is that we're definitely fishing more ocean to come up with the same amount of fish. You know, if you look at graphs displaying or maps looking at total fishing effort distributed around the world, in the 40s and 50s, it really hugged a fairly small portion of the ocean. But now we've reached a point, especially with long-range freezer trawlers and so forth, where pretty much every part of the ocean, of the world's oceans, is accessible and fishable, save, you know, the 1 or 2% of the ocean that has been put into marine protected areas. So I think it's something to look at. And then there's a third aspect to this whole thing, which is illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing. It's also called IUU fishing.
Right.
And something like 20% of the wild fish that we import appears to be coming from illegal fisheries. And so all those metrics about, is it, you know, maybe it isn't 80 million metric tons we're taking from the ocean. Maybe it's 100 million because, you know, a huge portion of it, we just don't know where it's coming from and who caught it and whether it was caught under any regulatory regime at all.
Thanks for the call, Paul. Before we go back to the phones, I wanted to ask another question about farm fish. Farmed fish requires fish for food. Is this cycle going to create problems as demand grows? Are we going to need to farm fish to feed farmed fish?
I don't think we'll ever farm fish to feed farm fish. You know, a nutritionist who used to be with USDA, a fisheries or fish nutritionist who worked a lot with farm fish, he once said to me that fish need nutrients, not ingredients. So it's really, they need omega-3 fatty acids, they need a range of, you know, protein and carbohydrates, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from fish. And the most exciting thing I've been kind of coming across over the last couple of years is a tremendous amount of innovation around fish feed. And so, you know, now we have algae that can produce omega-3 fatty acids for both humans and for fish. Curiously, one of the people I interviewed, not for the film, but for my book, which comes out next year, I interviewed senior manager at Cargill. And Cargill has figured out a way to take canola, right? You've used canola oil in the kitchen, I assume, right?
Sure.
So they've figured out how to take canola, the plant, it's called actually called rapeseed, and to do genetic modification to allow the oil that comes out of a land-based canola plant to actually be a long-chain EPA or DHA fatty acid so that you actually are growing the equivalent of seafood oils on land. If they figure that out and they break the sort of bottleneck around omega-3s for fish nutrition, then you could really see aquaculture explode worldwide.
I don't know. Pardon the pun, but that sounds a little fishy to me, I have to say.
Well, you know, the thing is everyone's always kind of, you know, getting hot in the collar about genetically modified organisms, including myself, and they don't want it to see the end product be GMO, right? Like no one would eat a GMO cow. They don't want GMO salmon, et cetera, et cetera. But meanwhile, huge amounts of the beef, the chicken that we eat is being raised and fed GMO corn and GMO soy. So it's a question of, you know, if you bury the GMO far enough down the food chain so that the consumer doesn't notice it, it's probably going to slip in.
Are there risks associated with genetic diversification or a lack of it when it comes to aquaculture?
Risks to the sort of to the biosphere or risks to humans?
Risk to the biosphere. Is there enough genetic diversity within the farmed setting to make sure that in the future if, you know, in some areas where there's too much of one type of timber being grown, trees being grown, if there's a disease that comes along, it can wipe out the whole area. Mm. Could that possibly happen with farmed fish?
Sure, and it does happen. And like any monoculture, you do open the pathway to disease. We've had huge disease issues, particularly in Chile, which doesn't have as good biosecurity measures as Norway. There was a big fish kill, I think, last year that I think had to do with an algal bloom. And then previously they've had big problems with a salmon disease called infectious salmon anemia. There's not really a way around that unless you have good biosecurity where, you know, you really, you know, make sure that your larvae are not spreading disease when you implant them in a new farm. Could you grow a polyculture of multiple species to perhaps dilute the risk of infection? That's one thought. I don't think anyone's going to grow multiple species of salmon in one place. But one of the things that I came across, not on this film but in previous research, is something called integrated multitrophic aquaculture, where you're growing salmon, mussels, kelp, sea cucumbers all within the same patch of ocean. And the effect of that is all these different species recycle the wastes of each other. Theoretically, if you're producing all those different kinds of seafood in one place, you don't have to overstock with salmon. You could be getting a profit from many different other creatures that you're growing. So that might be the way to go further down the line.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Madeline is in Fairbanks. Hi, Madeline.
Hi, can you guys hear me okay?
We can.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, awesome. First off, I just want to say thanks for your comments on Pauline Hilborn. I think the research does need to be pointed out in this conversation. That was a really good point on GMOs there. But I'm just curious from both the biological and economic side, what you've learned in your opinion on having both sustainable wild fisheries, such as Bristol Bay sockeye, continuing production, and sustaining a market alongside aquaculture markets.
Great question. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, you know, as I said earlier, the economic research on the influence of farmed salmon on wild salmon seems to imply that having farmed salmon in the marketplace has kind of given wild salmon a kick in the pants and has gotten people to eat more of both wild and farmed. But, you know, I guess is your question, are they ecologically compatible, having both farmed and wild? Is that your question?
Well, so obviously the markets influence each other. And, you know, when there's more farmed salmon available, they're not going to be buying as much wild salmon. And so there's been these competing markets that, at least from mine, seem from my perspective, the last few years here. And so more on that kind of sustainability.
Well, see, the thing is, the research seems to show that at first, when farmed salmon came onto the market, it did knock wild salmon on its butt, and you did see huge price drops. But the price of wild salmon has recovered. Now, I'm not talking about ex vessel. I'm talking about, you know, in the larger market. You're not seeing, I mean, right now, if you go to your average supermarket in the lower 48, you'll kind of see a similar price points. And actually, wild salmon is often pricier than farm salmon at this point. And it just depends. Actually, it goes back and forth. Sorry, I meant to say sometimes wild salmon is cheaper than farm salmon. It just goes back and forth. The concern ecologically going forward, I think, is, you know, sometimes I've heard grumblings about the idea of, well, Alaska has all of this processing capacity, right, throughout Southeast and Bristol Bay, and it's only used a couple of months out of the year when wild salmon hit the rivers. I've heard big investors in New York say, well, you know, we've got all this processing capability. Why don't we put salmon farms in Bristol Bay? Why don't we put salmon farms in Southeast so that we can use that processing capability when the wild salmon aren't going through? To me, that would probably be a mistake because, again, all these issues around sea lice, nutrification of estuaries, that's when I think you could see a real problem and where farmed fish could actually cause an actual decline in wild fish overall.
And also in parts of Alaska, those would definitely be fighting words.
Oh, sure, they'd be fighting words. And, you know, Uncle Ted, Ted Stevens, you know, made it very clear he didn't want farmed salmon in Alaska. And, I think there's a certain wisdom to that. Now, you know, looking forward and looking at this new presidential administration, which seems to be very gung-ho on mining, and, you know, we're seeing Pebble Mine come back into the news again. If Alaska decides to go down the route of industrialization, damming of rivers, polluting of rivers, and so forth, you know, then they may enter into the devil's bargain that the lower 48 has done, which is to say, and Canada to some degree, to say, you know what, we can't afford to keep so much Alaska wild, so let's sell off the minerals, let's sell off the petroleum, let's not really care too much about the rivers, and if we lose the spawning grounds, hang a few net pens, you know, in Bristol Bay and Prince William Sound, and we can grow our salmon and won't be a problem at all. I'm not saying that's my position, I'm just saying that sort of delete and replace mode has been the mode of humans in many places up until now. And so, you know, I think Alaskans really should have their hackles up and really guard against that happening.
Alaskans often have their hackles up, so that
and I appreciate
sustaining
that
probably, you know, won't be a problem.
I mean, I've been to Alaska, I think, 5 or 6 times, and every time it's like a slap in the face and a kick in the pants to remind you what a natural system looks like. I mean, I always say that when you fly over Alaska and, you know, during spawning season, it's a little bit like flying over Iowa in terms of, like, you see that Iowa needs so much land to produce so much corn. And likewise, you need so much estuary and so much river to produce so much salmon. And for some reason, you know, corn, Iowa corn is considered, you know, heartland America. But somehow, for some reason, the lower 48 doesn't appreciate that you have to keep all of this great country as wild country if you want all this wild salmon.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-478-8255 is the number to call statewide if you'd like to join our conversation today with author Paul Greenberg, who is the writer of New York Times best-selling books and also is the researcher and writer for the Frontline special that airs this evening called The Fish on My Plate. 1-800-478-8255, and in Anchorage, the number is 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Matt is in Sitka. Hi, Matt.
Oh, hi. Hi, Paul. Congratulations on knowing and mentioning Pacific Death Call Osculation. I'm I'm a commercial fisherman, and I know what that is. I think it's connected to the decline of, and I hope temporary decline of king salmon in particular in Alaskan waters. We're in the down cycle of PDO right now, and hopefully there'll continue to be an up cycle. There are other problems with farmed fish. One, farmed salmon are Atlantic salmon, which, you know, aren't really salmon, actually. They're a trout. They're in a different family than the Pacific salmon. And yep. Prices have not rebounded for commercial fishermen and all the salmon species. 2 years ago, I got paid less for Koa salmon than I did 25 years ago, and that's the direct result of farm fish. Farm fish, you mentioned sea lice. They infest the migratory king salmon that come north, the far-ranging Columbia River fish and other fish that come north to Alaska that have to swim past all those pins. Also, the Atlantic salmon have possibly introduced disease to the Pacific. I forget what it's called. I forget the initials. You might remember or might know.
Infectious salmon anemia, I think, is the one you're thinking of.
Yeah, right. And it hadn't been found in... I'm not sure that it never was in the Pacific, but it hadn't been found in the Pacific fish until after the introduction of Atlantic salmon farmed fish. So,
yeah.
I'm enjoying the discussion, by the way, and I've read your stuff in the New Yorker and elsewhere. So, there's so much you could say about farmed fish.
Well, let me ask you this question. Right. Let me ask you a question. You were saying that you did see an impact on coho prices. Is that because you feel like a coho goes more head to head with an Atlantic in the market?
Yes, it goes more head to head with Atlantic, and also it depends on how the sockeye run is doing. And you know, most of the sockeye comes from Alaska, but the big single fishery, of course, is Bristol Bay, and they had a better year than normal or than they expected. But both the farm fish, which are, remember, Atlantic salmon, not Pacific salmon, and the sockeye affected their price. It's really astounding to get a lower price than you did 25 years before.
That's very troubling.
Not all salmon has rebounded, and also it's always a threat. The price recently has rebounded in other species because of the very problems we've been mentioning about farm fish, about the diseases in Chile, which is the world's largest producer of that, and Norway. And they've had problems, so in Chile they had to kill off their whole year of fish, and that all of a sudden there was a gap in availability of fish, and the prices came up, but they're gearing up again, and they're continuing to grow. And
Thanks so much for the call, Matt. I want to get a question in about another fish farming operation that you visited, Paul Greenberg, near the Arctic Circle. Tell us about how they are working at this particular facility to provide not only cleaner food for the fish, but they also have a natural lice control process. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was in Kvaroy, in the far north of Norway, and they use a fish called a lumpsucker, which they create these sort of artificial kelp beds that the lumpsucker clings onto, and then the salmon swim into these artificial kelp beds, and the lumpsucker then basically cleans the salmon off like a car wash would clean off a salmon. I mean, clean off a car. And it seems to work. The other thing, though, that this Kvaroy farm was doing is that they had much lower stocking densities than they would have done at a bigger industrial farm. Mm. They were also using feed that was not derived from a directed wild reduction fishery. They were using offcuts from a wild fishery that just, instead of throwing out their guts and stuff, they use those guts to turn into fish meal and to feed to the farm fish. So it was a better model. I say that with a little bit of caution because, I know there are large amounts of the wild salmon community and also of the forage fish community and all these people who will just never accept the idea of a salmon farmed in the open ocean. And many people say that the only place for A-Farm salmon is in a recirculating facility on land where it can't affect the ocean. Problem with that is nobody has yet figured out really how to make that work economically because the energy inputs are so high to farm salmon on land.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll have more conversation with our guest, Paul Greenberg, about his special tonight on Frontline, The Fish on My Plate.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I have an email question, a few of them actually, but here's one from Rich in Sitka, Paul, that he's allergic to seafood. It's an iodine allergy. I have other friends who have the same thing. And so it's very severe. And he's worried about not getting omega fatty acids. What should he do? Any ideas?
So just remember, it's omega-3 fatty acids because there are omega-6s, omega-9s, omega-12s. But yes, can he get omega-3 fatty acids from non-seafood sources? Yes, you can. there are, as I might have mentioned earlier, there are a couple of companies selling algae omega-3 supplements, and they are long-chain fatty acids. I would, you know, based on the research that I've read, I would not get necessarily persuaded by the idea that you can just eat these land food omega-3s like flax, for example, and walnuts and all that. Those are different kinds of fatty acids. They're short-chain omega-3 fatty acids. So if you do believe in the benefits of a long-chain omega-3 fatty acid, I would go with an algal-based supplement. There's a company called Almega based out of Texas that makes them. There's a couple of them. There's another one who's working with sugarcane fed algae in Brazil. Terravia, I think it's called. They also make a cooking oil. So you can do it. And it's a little more expensive, but, you know, give it a try.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for that. One fish and kelp farmer that you visited with likened the early fish farming operations to Iowa pig farms in the ocean. Yuck. Mm-hmm. Tell us about his operation.
So, yeah, this is a guy named Bren Smith, and he has a company called the Thimble Island Oyster Company. And actually, he does not farm fish. He farms mollusks. He farms mussels, oysters, clams, kelp. And his argument is that these species are what are called non-fed aquaculture species. They do not require any inputs. They, in the case of mollusks, they live by filtering microalgae from the water, so they make the water cleaner. And in the case of kelp, they're actually removing nitrogen from the water and then through photosynthesis creating complex carbohydrates that are then removed from the water. So they're solving another issue of, you know, contemporary urban life where we have a lot of nitrogen wastes and phosphorus wastes that are going into our waterways. He truly believes that these are the creatures of the future. And again, if you look at the metrics, the biometrics on these creatures, they are the most efficient way to get omega-3s and protein onto the planet, onto the plate, that is animal protein. A mussel is something like 30 times more efficient from a carbon perspective than beef. So those are really great choices. The question then becomes to the consumer, do you want to be eating mussels and clams and oysters and kelp instead of your big chunk of flesh that you might have gotten, you know, accustomed to in these dark times of ours?
You spent time in Alaska, and as you mentioned earlier, you come here about once a year. A hatchery manager in Sitka said to you that the hatchery is sort of like a head start for salmon, like preschool almost. What was he referencing there? What did he mean?
Actually, he wasn't a hatchery manager, although we did.
Oh, sorry.
He's a fisherman, but we did talk to hatchery people. But so Alaska does this sort of controversial thing where, particularly in Southeast, about 30% of the wild salmon out there are supplemented. They begin their lives in a hatchery. They're released when they're smolts, and then they imprint on wherever they're released. They go out to sea, come back a couple of years later, and then they're harvested. In the case of the place I went to in Sitka, they were actually put into an inlet that didn't even have a river. So they imprinted on a place they could never spawn anyway. the controversy around this, there are two controversies. One is that when you think about evolutionary selection pressures, the greatest selection happens from going from an egg to a smolt. And during those very fragile months and weeks and so forth, that's when nature really chooses which fish to survive and which fish should die. And there are people who argue that by putting these hatchery fish into our inlets in Alaska, that we're weakening the stock. And then, of course, the other thing is to say that, you know, we only have so many salmon out there because there's only so much feed out there in the ocean pastures, and that by supercharging our rivers and our inlets and so forth with additional pinks, mostly pinks and chums, that we're actually overtaxing the ocean and could lead to eventual, you know, planktonic conflicts between salmon, you know, hatchery raised salmon and purely wild salmon. So it's an issue.
We only have a minute or two left. I wanted to ask about, I know that you don't want to steal your thunder for tonight's program, but I'm fairly certain you felt better than the guy who ate only fast food for a year. But tell us what changes did you have? What occurred for you over that year? Weight, clarity, all that sort of
certainly
thing.
You know, I certainly lost weight, and part of that is because of the confounding factor of, you know, when you order fish in a restaurant versus meat, it usually comes with a side order of a healthy thing, right? You know, you order the salmon, and it comes with the broccoli. You order the burger, it comes with the fries. So that just de facto made me lose weight. I certainly felt a little, my mood was better. And they do say omega-3 fatty acids have something to do with depression. I suffer from a little bit of marginal depression. And on the other hand, the confounding factor there was that I had a book to write. And as I wrote more and more of it, my depression got lighter and lighter. So, you know, there's all these kind of confounding factors that come up on this kind of experiment. And, you know, I think one has to look at it not necessarily as an ironclad scientific experiment, but a means of investigating a question.
You cite a passage from Melville's Moby Dick. What kind of society might we have been if we hadn't been landsmen tied to counters, nailed to benches, clinched to desks, but instead became a society fixed in ocean reveries? At the end of your year-long search, how would you answer that question?
I think we'd be a healthier country if, let's say, the omega-3 part of our nutrition portfolio had a higher standing. I think we've changed our country to accommodate annual crops, confined animal fed operations that feed pigs and cows and chickens. I think if we were to orient ourselves towards the sea and the healthy environment that seafood requires, I think overall we would be a healthier country.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Paul, for being our guest today. Your book on the Omega Question is coming out next year. You've already got a couple of books out on fish. And tonight on Frontline at 9 p.m. across Alaska, the 90-minute special called The Fish on My Plate will be airing on PBS stations across the state. Paul Greenberg is the researcher, the author of The Fish on My Plate, as well as a couple of other books that I'm trying to find the titles of right now.
Four Fish and American Catch.
Thank you. Thanks to Paul Greenberg. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, Wesley Early on phones. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week with another Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.